I've never really used one of these. Tell me, Mr. Bannon, what do you have to say about this?
It's an all-new, all-different podcast from Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
Hello, LGM readers and listeners to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. My name's Rob, and I have with me today here in Lexington, Kentucky, David Watkins, who is one of the founding members of Lawyers, Guns, and Money, still currently a front pager on the blog. And today we're going to talk about transit politics, right, and the politics of mass transit and so forth, which has become one of his interests. You want to say hi?
Hello, readers.
I guess to start off with, the politics of transit were not your thing when you were in graduate school. So how did you become interested in sort of a lot of the politics of transit issues?
And I should say, the politics of transit, you know, are still not my thing in any kind of meaningful academic sense, right? I mean, it's not something I would say that I actually study, but I think I have, I've always been interested in transit. I mean, when I was a kid, I grew up in a relatively small and isolated town, but it had, for a town of its size, a decent bus system. You know, there were only like five routes in town. They ran hourly or maybe half hourly, you know, 12 hours a day. But my mom didn't drive, and we used them a lot to get around. And I've always been interested in transit, and I began graduate school with a kind of interest in environmental politics, and that led me to thinking a lot about how we should be thinking about what our cities should look like and how our cities should be constructed. And I think transit is obviously a central part of that. And I've always been a transit rider. I've never owned a car. So it's a kind of combination of various personal and academic concerns.
So both of us have made sort of this big transition from the Pacific Northwest to the Upper Midwest, right? So you live in Dayton, I live in Lexington, and I am going to call Lexington the Upper Midwest. I know, Lexington would be the Lower Midwest. Dayton would sort of be the Mid-Midwest, I guess. I mean, does it think of itself as Upper Midwest?
I think not exactly. I think Ohio... You know, there's a case to be made that the northern half of Ohio is Upper Midwest, and the southern half of Ohio is something else. It's clearly not in the Appalachians. Dayton has a kind of Appalachian feel. It's close enough. That's where many of its residents' ancestors came from. So I would say Dayton is not in the Upper Midwest.
All right. So that digression aside, both of us have, you know, witnessed what is the shift from the Northwest to this part of the country is a profoundly different transit environment, right? So, and we've talked about this before, right? Sort of in the Seattle region, you can take what amounts to a city bus from, you know, basically almost the Canadian border to and then you can get yourself all the way to Olympia, and that's what, 120 miles, something like that, and you have to negotiate a couple different systems to do that, right? But and it's not expensive and it's not convenient or anything else, but it's a doable thing. But if you want to go from Dayton to Lexington, which is you have to take a Greyhound bus, right? And I mean, and the train infrastructure similarly, right? I mean, there are a couple different trains that Amtrak that run down the Pacific Coast, and there's basically nothing like that in the Bluegrass or in Ohio. And so the mass transit infrastructure here, despite geographic similarity, is just profoundly different, right? And it's also different in city, right? And you know, part of this is just kind of my memory of Seattle, but Seattle has a really good bus system, and now it has a light rail system, right? And, you know, those things may have changed, but the difference between there and here, the difference between Cincinnati and Seattle, is pretty profound.
So the thing that I find really striking and really frustrating, frankly, is there is no bus, and there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of energy for any kind of transit connection between Dayton and Cincinnati. And Dayton and Cincinnati are about 50, 55 miles apart. they are very distinct, right? As much as people try to talk about it as sort of one growing, you know, region, they have very distinct identities, right? And I don't think Daytonians, there are in fact proud Daytonians, and they would not understand themselves as residents of some sort of secondary city in the greater Cincinnati area.
Right, and that's very similar to Tacoma, right? Tacoma's position in the Seattle and the Puget Sound area, right?
Right. That's the analogy. Tacoma's a little bit closer. Tacoma's about 40 miles from Seattle. But the number of there's a heavy rail commuter train that runs, you know, I think 8 trains peak direction, 2 or 3 trains off peak. They're starting to add some midday service. And then there's buses every 10 or 15 minutes most of the day and well into the evening. There's probably 70 buses a day between Seattle and Tacoma. And the idea of not having a transit, and those are express buses, those get on the freeway. So the fact that there's nothing, that there's no like collection of slow local routes through the suburbs that would connect Dayton and Cincinnati is really kind of striking to me. So Dayton's bus system for a sort of urban and some of the close-in suburbs is actually, in some ways, it's better than I would have expected. It has impressive coverage for a poor, low-density, shrinking city. That there aren't that many places you can't get reasonably close to by bus. And then most of those bus routes have an impressive span of service. You know, they start very early in the morning. They run until midnight or so, 7 days a week. So that is impressive. Very few of those buses are actually frequent, and very few of those buses are actually fast. And there's not much of a grid, right? So if you're going almost anywhere from point A to point B, you take a slow bus to the downtown transit center and you transfer to another slow bus, even if that's going well out of your way, because it's not constructed as a grid at all. My, you know, views on transit best practices is that grids are better and we should have grids, but I'm not even sure I would advocate for that in Dayton, because I'm not sure the density is there. I think a sort of radical restructure of the bus routes there would be something of a burden for a lot of riders in a way that was sort of less true in Houston, which is the place where a restructure of that sort was recently done to significant positive effect, I think. One of the things about following transit politics in Dayton is that there's just not that much to follow. There's these legacy routes. They've been in the same place for, as far as I can gather, quite a while. And there's not much impulse to change them. There were recently some cuts because the state, somebody in state government, I didn't follow this too closely, decided that transit was collecting this tax that they were never supposed to have been collecting all along. And so all Ohio agencies lost 3 to 5% of their funding, and they had to cut some. I think that Dayton, you know, the RTA in Dayton probably did about as well with the cuts as they could have. They cut what I think they more or less should have cut, which is they didn't really threaten too much of that basic coverage map. But in Dayton, transit is mostly for poor people. Right, choice riders are fairly rare, and that's a big difference from Seattle.
Right, I mean that's been my experience in Cincinnati, which I lived in a couple of years, but then especially in Lexington. Right, I mean, it seems like that for sort of the broad social class we inhabit, which is sort of white middle class, because we're academics and that's what we do. Right. Buses are an inconvenience because they often go slow in front of your car, and sometimes they unpredictably stop to pick up people, quote unquote, and those just prevent you from getting places. And I mean, it's really surprising to me coming from the Seattle, and Seattle was sort of because I moved to Seattle from Eugene, and people rode the bus in Eugene, but in Seattle it was the way to get around, right? And like finding people who didn't ride the bus in Seattle and sort of had this, had never ridden the bus. I mean, that was an extremely rare thing. But it's extraordinarily common here, you know, and I, both here and in both in Lexington and Cincinnati, that, you know, this experience of riding a metro bus is just completely alien, to, sort of the daily lived life. And I mean, there must be, like all sorts of class markers, race markers, and so forth from this part of the country, which are not as evident in the Northwest just because of the historical experience. But that seems like kind of an obstacle too, right, to sort of thinking about how transit can expand and so forth, right? I mean, I guess I'm not sure about that. I mean, there had to be good rail connections between Dayton and Cincinnati at some point in sort of the American historical experience, right?
Yeah. I'm sure there were. I don't have a great sense of that history, but I'm sure there were interurbans that certainly connected places like Middletown to Dayton and probably Middletown to Cincinnati. I'd be shocked if there hadn't been something like that, you know, prior to the 40s when most of that went away. But I don't actually know the particular history there. The sort of diversity of bus ridership in Seattle was... It was really quite evident in my last job in Seattle at Seattle U. I took two buses to commute, and I took a bus downtown and then a bus up the hill to First Hill. And so the bus downtown from East Ballard, 28X, I would get on the bus in the morning and look around. And I'd say with some confidence that I was almost certainly one of the worst dressed and lowest income people on that bus. And then I would get off downtown and I would get on the 2, which goes up to First Hill and has a stop near the methadone clinic. And the opposite was true. I was probably the best paid and, best dressed person on that bus. And that was just typical. And there is no 28X in Dayton. There's no bus like that I'm aware of.
I mean, the last time I rode the bus in Seattle, which I believe was back from your bachelor party, or maybe it was your rehearsal dinner. Somebody was trying to sell stolen liquor out of the back seat. He had just these bottles of clearly liquor that he had stolen from a local liquor store, and he was trying to sell them cut rate to people in the back of the bus, which included myself and Scott and Scott's wife Emily and so forth. So it's a fun experience. As long as nobody gets stabbed, it's a fun experience. So one of the reasons what we're thinking about this today is, and you sent me this, and you've talked a little bit about this in some places, is sort of the modern crisis of American transit, which has sort of come upon us suddenly, right? It's come upon us suddenly, and it's come upon us as sort of as part of the general post-crisis economic growth. And there was recently a Washington Post article which detailed quite a bit of what's going on. But I mean, transit systems in urban areas across the country are dropping riders, they are dropping revenue, and this seems to be a pretty consistent thing. So, I mean, I know you've paid more attention to this, so maybe.
Yeah, so and it's difficult to track exactly how this relates to larger sort of economic crises because the timing is a bit off, right? So, you know, transit ridership, you know, was in the U.S. was very high until the end of the streetcar era, and then, you know, in the middle of the 20th century, it was very low, and in the 70s, you had many of the modern, you know, kind of transit systems. Take their current form with a greater focus on buses, and then it was fairly steady. And since about 1990, transit ridership had been sort of steadily gaining ground, and there were a lot of expansions of light rail systems during that era, as well as some more dubious streetcars. But ridership sort of was trending up until about 3 years ago, and we start to see the decline in about 2015. The last year we have data for, the decline seems to be worse. I think from 16 to 17, the average loss is about 3%. And so that's fairly significant. And that puts pressure on transit systems because of lost fare revenue, obviously. But it also creates a difficult political situation, and a political situation that could sort of take a bad situation and make it worse, right? If transit is less efficient, justification for funding it, it creates this opening for transit's enemies, right? And I just saw an article from the Washington Policy Center, which is this anti-transit think tank in Washington, making the case that Spokane should, because of declining ridership, should abandon this plan for this central bus rapid transit line that the voters had just voted for, right? And so it opens the door for transit's enemies. And then, of course, you have a vicious circle, right? Once you start making cuts to service, ridership continues to decline, and it's unclear how exactly you dig yourself out of that situation that you've created. There's no real consensus on what the causes are, right? Obviously, gas is pretty cheap, and that's certainly part of the story. There's reason to believe that the growth in rideshare is part of the story. And I think in general, just the basic, this is a little bit harder to pinpoint as a precise cause because this has sort of been more permanently true, but I think it doesn't help that transit is in a difficult political situation that I'll probably talk about more later, but transit agencies have a hard time getting, you know, the resources they need, sometimes not even kind of financial resources, but, you know, access to roads resources, lanes, signal priority, stuff like that, because for a variety of reasons, but one is that they don't have, even in places where transit is fairly popular, they don't have politicians who understand their self-interest as I must defend and protect quality transit. I must get, good return for investment on money spent on transit. There just aren't politicians who see themselves that way. And I think that that's a significant part of the problem. But one of the things I've been meaning to write about for the blog is that I think it's troubling to me that more kind of progressive voices, environmentalists and so on, are not kind of running around like their hair's on fire right now. They're not seeing this or treating this as a kind of serious crisis that requires immediate attention. I think that's a mistake.
Right. So, I mean, the reasons and you know, whatever, sort of broad-based trends are hard to track down sort of singular causes for. You know, the reasons for the reduction, you know, we can say that there are a few that are just flatly wrong, right? I mean, it's not because the economy is growing, so people need to get to places, right? At least theoretically. It's not some sort of sudden cultural shift against or it wouldn't seem to be some sort of sudden cultural shift on attitudes about, because the attitudes, there's no reason to believe they've changed, right? The gas is part of it, right? But the gas, I mean, the gas prices have been fairly consistent since, 2010, 2011? I mean, they've actually ticked up a little bit, it feels like. So that one seems to be kind of a hard one for me. I mean, so The ones that I've seen that seem the most compelling are sort of the growth of rideshare, Uber and Lyft in particular, and telework, right? This that people are not, they don't need to go in the same way. They don't need to leave their homes in the same way that they did in the past. I mean, are those the reasons you've seen, or are there other ones that are out there?
Yeah, I think those probably make the most sense. I also think it's, you know, there's a lot of variation, right? What makes sense in some areas may not make sense in others. This is also true, I think, and Scott had a post about this, and I think I had a post about this fairly recently, about the excessive costs for building transit infrastructure in the United States, right? There was that great piece in the New York Times that looked at the Second Avenue subway and its obscene costs, and I think a lot of people came away from that concluding, well, it's, you know, unions are the problem, right? The unions, fetter betting and all that. That was a serious issue in terms of cost there. But there are inflated costs in other systems that seem to have their own kind of local causes. And I think, you know, it makes more sense to talk about the main cause being politicians not that interested in, you know, fighting to keep costs down. is probably the central, whether they're going against, whether they're negotiating with unions or contractors or NIMBYs or whoever else.
Right, but that's weird because, all the studies I've seen about this have said that this is not a cross-national phenomenon. This is something that sort of the incredibly high cost of transit is something that is local to the United States, which means it has to be something that is about sort of the specific structure of federalism and sort of how municipalities function, or, I mean, what's the argument there?
See, and I have some puzzlement about this. I'm not really quite confident, right? Scott talked about the construction of Link in the Seattle area as being, much cheaper and more efficient than the Second Avenue subway, and that's true. But building light rail mile for mile in Seattle costs about twice as much as it does in Vancouver. And labor costs are not significantly different, in Vancouver and Seattle. And in neither place do unions seem to be particularly adept at absorbing excessive resources through feather bedding and that kind of thing. I do think probably the best explanation other than the straight political one in the United States is sort of the empowerment of NIMBYs raises the costs of transit, right, in a variety of ways. There's a portion of East Link, which is part of the planned light rail system in the Seattle area, that's going to be in a tunnel when there was a, perfectly good and much, much, much cheaper, surface route that would not have actually slowed anything down given where it was. It didn't cross any roads or anything like that. But it was really a group of just, maybe 100 homeowners whose backyards would have been near that who managed to put that train underground. I mean, we could have saved money giving them, huge checks to accept the train rather than. So I do think kind of the empowerment of NIMBYs is higher in the U.S. than most countries who are building significant transit, and that seems to be, I think, the most unique thing structurally. But clearly, there's more to the story than that. But I think that's probably where I would land on that, but I don't have much confidence in that.
No, I mean, that makes sense to me, right? I mean, if you think about it in terms of sort of how the sort of civic legal system has manifested and supported certain kinds of ownership in the United States, right? And especially the tools to protect certain forms of ownership differently in the United States than other places, right? Where it's harder to sort of just take, and, I mean, NIMBYs are not always wrong, right? And the tools that people are given to protect themselves from cities and other things are not always. But they do seem to be more extensive in the United States than in other countries, right? And so that sort of necessarily drives up the cost of litigation. It drives up the incentives for sort of litigation and so forth, and that those, can be problematic for these kinds of. And, I think the other thing you're sort of getting at too, right, is just, and I guess the New York example is kind of interesting here, but also the Washington examples, the DC examples, is that, you're right that there just aren't a lot of public officials who have a ton of interest in making transit cheaper, right? I mean, it's just sort of in making new construction projects cheaper. And that it's going to become even less so if these technology or the trends in ridership continue, right? That those could be quite negative.
Yeah, absolutely. And, two stories about that. One from the Seattle area. Eventually, the light rail that's being built out in Seattle is planned to reach Everett, which is a secondary city about 35 miles north of Seattle. Again, as with Tacoma, served by many, many, many buses all day right now. And when Link does get to Everett, it's going to take this detour that's going to cost riders, I think, 6 to 8 minutes in each direction to stop at Payne Field. Payne Field is sprawling, right? Insofar as it's a job center, there are dreams. Civic leaders in Snohomish County have dreams of that being a secondary airport to SeaTac, and I believe Alaskan is going to start flying some commercial flights later this year. I'm skeptical that SeaTac in the region actually need a secondary airport, and I'm skeptical that there will be commercial flights there in 10 years, but that's their hope. there's barely any bus service to Painfield right now, and there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of demand for it, and the structure of Painfield is just sprawling. There are jobs there, but once you get off the light rail, you're probably not within walking distance of your job. So it's an incredibly questionable, I think the political leaders of Snohomish County have been driving this, not the transit agency. The transit agency would never have come up with an idea like this, right? But you know, they have dreams for Painfield. They want Painfield to be much more than it is as a commercial airport, as a job center. There's some sense that Boeing, like the idea of having light rail come to Painfield, and Boeing is a major player there. And there was just really no kind of meaningful resistance to making this transit effectively worse, right? The transit was kind of hijacked. Transit funding, which was voted for by the citizens, they really want it. They want more. They always vote for more in the Seattle area. Was hijacked by political leaders who have other agendas. In this case, the agenda is a secondary airport and the kind of placemaking of Painfield. You see this a lot with streetcars, right? Streetcars that are sort of ineffective as actual transit, right? And even the best, most highest ridership, best streetcars in the country are in Portland, and in the, you know, still faster to walk in many cases than ride the streetcar in Portland. But they're funded for what we might call placemaking reasons, right? As sort of, you know, vehicles of gentrification and redevelopment in parts of cities that civic leaders hope for. But then there's, you know, the story that I saw coming through last night is that the B-82 bus line in Brooklyn, which carries 28,000 riders a day, which if I'd had more time, I was going to look up and try and figure out how many single bus routes have greater ridership than that. None in Seattle do. None in Seattle are that high. I think there's a few in the Bay Area, and probably maybe in New York, others in New York as well. But that's a huge ridership for a single bus line, and it's a terrible bus line. It averages 7 miles an hour in speed. Its frequency, its on-time rate is incredibly low. And so New York has this plan to turn it into something of a bus rapid transit isn't the right term, but to give it its own lane, to give it signal priority, and you know, and this makes a ton of sense. And that would have entailed the removal of 134 parking spaces, right? And so basically, Marty Golden and a bunch of other New York area Brooklyn politicians kind of went to war against this plan to stop it, to protect 134 parking spaces from significantly improving a bus that serves 28,000 people in the country's most transit-centric city. You know, and of course they're all Democrats, right? You know, they represent Brooklyn, so you know, and that's really kind of striking to me. And De Blasio is going along with it, right? De Blasio is not. I don't know if he's in favor of it or he just doesn't see any interest in trying to stand up for this project. But that's a striking example of where our politics are on this and where our politicians are on this. There's politicians who really kind of stand up for transit and transit riders and future transit riders are few and far between.
So, I mean, this brings us to the question, what does our dystopian future hold, right? And so, you know, if we identify, I mean, so these political things have been around for a while, and they may be trending in particular directions. I mean, but the ones that you do are potentially transformative seem to me to be the technological issues, right? You know, and I know that people talk a lot about sort of what autonomy does, sort of in terms of autonomous vehicles on the one hand, but then also sort of what this teleworking issue has. I mean, what kind of guess would you make about sort of the future of the urban system at this point, where there seems to be kind of this greater, sort of ever greater cultural interest in, no, let me rephrase. There has been a sort of a rekindling of interest in what a dense urban area can provide to people, right? In ways that are kind of alien to sort of the suburban experience of the 1980s and even the 1990s, right? And, you know, this has lots of implications. It has lots of sort of downstream effects with respect to sort of sort of how difficult it is to have kids or, you know, whatever. But, you know, we there's a recognition now in ways that weren't always there in the past about sort of what density has to offer. You know, are these technological changes, you know, in particular the ride sharing and sort of the telework, do those, I mean, what kind of urban center do these kinds of things, you know, kind of in conjunction with transit, tell us about the future of the American urban space? I know I'm asking you to speculate wildly here, but I'm curious your thoughts.
So on the one hand, of those two kind of technological developments, I view them rather differently, right? I don't view them as of a piece with each other. So in terms of telework and just working from remote places, and the kind of transit community that I follow on Twitter, you know, and read, are really kind of two minds about this. I mean, I think I see a lot of people who are real skeptics that this is going to be particularly transformative, and they cite, you know, some research that suggests that there are a variety of productivity issues with telework, and I think others are sort of more skeptical of that and see, you know, a more flexible workforce. And I'm less confident in terms of speculating about that. On the rideshare side, you know, it seems to me, and Scott's written about this, and I largely agree with him. And, you know, on the one hand, I harbor some anti Uber sentiment in me, and I think, in particular, in cities where, you know, the taxi industry had serious problems, whether in terms of quality of service or who they'll serve, or just simply in terms of not, you know, restricting the supply such that there were just not enough cabs available. All those problems existed in Seattle. And, you know, so in some ways I think the advent of rideshare was good. And it was good for people who are trying to live without a car, right? Because transit can't provide all the trips. And if you're relying on taxis and, you know, having them actually be available when you need them is important. On the other hand, it's clear that Uber and Lyft's model is not sustainable financially, right? That they're essentially, venture capital is subsidizing our cab rides right now. Things that can't go on forever won't, right? And I think venture capital subsidizing our cab rides is one of those things that's not going to go on forever. It could go on for longer than it makes any reasonable sense that it should, but it won't go on forever. And the autonomous car situation is, I think, more kind of concerning from a labor perspective, that once you sort of have a commitment to sort of dense development or, dense urban living, it's not solving the central problem. Cars are a geometry problem, right? There's not enough space to store them all. There's not enough road space to have people moving that way. So in some lower density places, it's interesting. I'm still not sure I see the economics working out as that being a major competitor to transit. But certainly in the more dense urban centers, I think it's I'm not as concerned about it. So for the future, you know, I think the rideshare, if this decline in ridership is about rideshare competition, and I admit I've been that person before, you know, where I would normally take a bus and the bus is running late and, you know, it's only going to cost me like $5 to take the rideshare ride. I'll just take the rideshare ride. I see that, you know, in my own transit use. But I don't think that's going to last forever. I think that model just isn't built to last. And I do think that the political situation is changing in some interesting ways. And one of the impediments to higher transit ridership is legalizing more housing near transit, right? And you can't talk about transit without talking about land use. And there, I think the political kind of I sense a political shift, especially on the West Coast, that the sort of you know, paying attention to elections in Seattle, the sort of the more classic kind of left NIMBY candidates, you know, have been losing to, I think, a much smarter, more sensible kind of liberalism that just sees the value of letting the city grow and growing the city in and letting more density happen. And, you know, every So I do think, and of course the elephant in the room there is Senate Bill 827 in California, which I really need to blog about. But, you know, if something like that were to pass that isn't completely watered down, I think that could be a huge boon to transit systems in California. So I see, I think sort of the revival of kind of urban life has a political face to it that just is pushing for essentially legalizing, you know, more urban living. And I think there's almost no way that doesn't portend well for transit if that kind of shift begins to see more political victories.
I mean, right. It does seem that sort of the claims that were once taken quite seriously, sort of anti-development arguments that were taken quite seriously about sort of the need to protect the character of one's neighborhood and so forth, are taken less seriously now, right? I mean, and perhaps that's the wrong way of phrasing, right? But the real costs of that approach to everyone are now being seen, right? You know, it's not wrong to want to preserve the character of one's neighborhood, but while doing that, you're also driving up your own property values, right? Which is making you more wealthy and at the same time impoverishing other people, right? So, yeah, and I think this is probably a question for a different podcast, right? But sort of my understanding of a lot of the land use arguments right now and the development arguments sort of suggest the really baneful effect that Airbnb is having on vacancy rates and on rents in a lot of urban areas that people can make out of Airbnb without having to deal with sort of the nonsense of having tenants. Anyway, do you have any additional thoughts, anything else you wanted to say before we go?
I'll just add, I'm a little bit skeptical about the size of the Airbnb effect. That's a fairly technical argument, and of course the data, you know, is imperfect. But I'm somewhat skeptical about that. I'm also a little bit, you know, Airbnb represents what we would call a short-term rental market, right? And I think, like, it's true that, you know, Airbnb engages in some of the bad behavior that that many tech startups do. That and on the other hand, I think some people who are frustrated with Airbnb and then talk about it as if Airbnb and a short-term rental market are identical things. There has always been a short-term rental market. There will be a short-term rental market when Airbnb is gone, right? And I think one of the things I've come to believe about urban life and is that there are going to be short-term residents and there are going to be visitors for whom hotels are probably not a great option, and that's part of urban living and part of life. So I think insofar as Airbnb is having a negative effect on the rental market, that's in many ways a product of the general shortage, more than something Airbnb itself is doing. So I have, in addition to harboring some heretical anti-Uber sentiments, I harbor some heretical anti-Airbnb sentiments as well. But that you're right, that's probably a big subject that probably deserves its own podcast.
Oh, heresy, heresy. Well, Dave, thank you for joining us today. And LGM listeners, thank you for listening. And please feel free to comment anything you have to say in the comment thread. Also, feel free to review the podcast on iTunes or anywhere else that you see fit to listen to podcasts. Thank you so much and have a good day.
Let's go.